AJ, ladies and gentlemen, like I promised you, we have a message from Dusty Rhodes and his doctor. I was there. So let's go to Dr. Estwanek and Dusty Rhodes right now.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Following Rustic Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown Estate and from the live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 112 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston. And today, I'm going to be going back to the year 1985. Yeah, I know, it kind of sounds like Back to the Future, but it's appropriate because this is NWA Worldwide from October 26th, 1985. The day, well, it was in the early morning hours when Marty McFly went down to the Twin Pines Mall to meet up with Doc Brown, who admittedly probably isn't a person that a high schooler should be hanging out with. I feel like there should have been a prequel to explain that relationship in a little bit more detail, but it's been a while since I've seen the three pictures, especially three, because I just remember being bored by that in the beginning. But anyway, this show, NWA Worldwide, from late 85 in the lead-up to Starrcade, a very, very hot show with a lot going on, a lot of moving pieces, but there is one dominant personality that kind of carries through throughout the program, and that would be one Mr. Arn Anderson, whose name in real life is actually Marty, so I find it somewhat appropriate. But before I get into all that, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. That's greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. And as suspected from last week's show, that woman who talked to me for like 7 minutes about my podcast definitely did not listen because she did not answer the call. And I knew it was going to happen because it was her blood alcohol was probably about 0.19 at the time. Anyway, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. More on Pro Wrestling Only and all that you can find there coming up a little bit later on. I've noticed now, this is the third year in doing this podcast. And one of the weeks that is hardest for me to actually do this show, I would have thought like around holidays or when I was, you know, going on vacation somewhere, like those would be tough weeks to get everything in. And those haven't been as much of a problem. But what I have seen, and you know, I'm a huge hockey fan and all, that the first round of the hockey playoffs, trying to do a podcast during that, for me, it's very, very difficult. In fact, I did this show, just to give you a peek behind the curtain, I recorded the whole show over the course of the week, but I never recorded an intro until, yes, this is going to be released on Thursday morning. I'm actually talking right now on Thursday morning because, like, well, the Bruins are probably going to be eliminated from the playoffs or they're going to advance or something's going to happen, so I should probably wait. And then I just kept waiting. And then I never found a time because I would be like, oh, I got to stay up till 1:30 in the morning to watch the Vegas Golden Knights and San Jose Sharks Game 7, which, by the way, was well worth it for those of you out there who were not watching Damian Lillard just assassinate the Oklahoma City Thunder once and for all. Good for the Pacific Northwest to get a little revenge on the former Seattle Sonics. When I make that point about being harder to do the podcast, because it was last year on this week that I threw out the first Best Of show, the Best of the Heel Turns Volume 1, check it out in the archives, and then the year before that, I think it was episode 10, I released that on a Friday, and I was recording it like right up to the point in which I released it, sort of like this one, where I was actually watching an NHL playoff game as I'm like rushing through the end of the show. So I don't know. I should maybe mark this on my calendar and prepare for it a little bit more, now that I actually know what's going on. Of course, this past weekend was Easter weekend. Getting my family together, I mean, it's rather difficult. Like, one of my sisters went to her in-laws, and that's fine. But finally, an exchange of Christmas presents took place on, what was it, April 20th, whatever the hell it was. So, I can't believe it, but I got a new sweatshirt to run in, which, you know, now that it's summer, I probably won't be wearing those as much, but kind of interesting. But there were, over the weekend, a couple of things came up in terms of etiquette and just, you know, dear life in these United States kind of things from the old Reader's Digest. And they both, you know, happened when I was out with my wife. And first of all, she got really pissed off at me when we went to CVS, because I go up and I buy allergy medication. And as anybody who needs to buy Claritin D knows, you have to go to the counter, at least in this country, and bring up the little card or whatever that says Claritin D, 15 tablets, whatever. Now, we got into this huge debate before we even got to CVS about the card. Do you bring up the card to the pharmacist? And I do bring up the card, basically, so that there's no mistaking that this is what I want. Sometimes they don't have the card with the 15 tablets out there, so you have to give them the 10, and then you ask for the 15, and they say, oh, sorry, we don't have any, so they only give you 10. But my wife, she's like, no, you just tell them what you want. You say Claritin D, blah, 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 or Claritin D generic, and they'll get it for you. I'm like, well, you know, they could screw up and bring you the wrong thing. Well, anyway, long story short, I bring up the card. My wife gets all pissed off about it because I did the opposite of what she said I should do. And then they ring me up. I go, and then I get home and I notice they gave me the 12-hour formula instead of the 24-hour formula. But I still stand by my theory, because I think if you don't bring the card up, they're even more likely to screw up that sort of thing. But nevertheless, so we go to a tap room, and there, I love this thing that we have now in America where we have local tap rooms by various breweries, and one of my favorites is down in Hudson, Mass, called Medusa Brewing, but it's like 35 minutes away, so we don't go there very often. They always have a very good selection. Sometimes it gets crowded, though, on Saturdays. So as we're walking in, we're behind another couple, and I would say that they were in their late 40s, just sort of estimating that. And as we get in there, there are only 4 seats available at the bar, and they're all side by side, those 4 seats. Now, these 2 people in front of us, which of those 4 seats do you think they took? Well, and of course, they took the 2 freaking middle seats and left a single seat on one side and a single seat on the other side. I feel like you should be able to slap the shit out of the man in that case for doing something like that. I mean, where are we as a society if you... They saw us, too, walking in right behind them and decided to take the middle 2 seats. What a bunch of dicks. It's kind of like if you're in the bathroom and you're, you know, let's say there's 6 urinals and you're the only one there and a guy comes in and uses the one next to you. What the hell? I mean, that's not how things are done. This is not how we were raised. That is not why John Hancock put his, you know, name on the Declaration of Independence. It really bothered me, and I've been sitting on this for a number of days, but I kind of bit my tongue at the time because, you know, I don't want to get banned from there. I don't want this to be like a Seinfeld situation where there's like, we don't want your business or anything like that. Oh, in Seinfeld, that happened like 8 different times, like businesses just saying, yeah, we don't want you. We don't want you around. We don't want your money. Like, yes, in the competitive environment of New York City, you should be banning customers that you don't like. But anyway, clearly that must have happened to Larry David a lot, because he was probably just irritating enough for that to make sense. So, NWA Worldwide 1985, yeah, that is what the show is about. And there is a lot of Arn Anderson on this program, which I get to explore him from various different angles, kind of speculate on, you know, what he could have been had he been, I don't know, let's say a politician. Arn Anderson wearing a hat, Arn Anderson giving legal advice. There's all sorts of fun things going on here. We're also going to hear from the Boogie Woogie Man, Jimmy Valiant, who's got some issues with the Midnight Express around this time, but he gets an assist from a young woman. Oh, wait, no, that's not a woman. That's a man, baby. And the Rock and Roll Express, to follow up on their appearance last week with Ricky Morton getting pile-driven through a freaking table, they are on the show as well. They had just lost their tag team titles to the Russians, the three Russians, kind of working the Freebird rule on that one. And the other big storyline from this show is everybody remembers Starrcade 85, the match in Steel Cage, the I Quit match between Magnum TA and Tully Blanchard. What you don't really talk about with that sort of thing a lot is what exactly built to that match. Yes, obviously you figure that they had matches that would lead to an I Quit match, but here on this show we have Magnum TA making the request for the I Quit match, and we're going to hear how that went down. And he is later confronted by Tully Blanchard's valet, Baby Doll, and some stuff happens, some Me Too action that Magnum TA opens himself up for, and it leads to some great results in not only building to the match, but also delighted me as well. So I feel like that sets the table well enough. I should also mention that before next week's show, I'm turning 40 years old, so I should probably make these shows shorter so that I don't, like, die or something, you know, in the middle of recording it. I mean, that would be a real tragedy, because then it probably wouldn't get posted, because I don't think my wife knows how to do this, and I don't think she really cares if it would get posted all that much. Well, I mean, presumably because she would be in mourning or whatever. I'm probably just going to hang out at a tap room on my birthday and call it an autograph signing and, like, say, hey, friends, you want to come by and have a beer or whatever? That'd be great. So, I don't know. This is episode number 112. So, in continuation of my series that's been ongoing for quite a while now, since episode 80, be looking at some sports moments from the year 2012. So why don't I kick it off with one that I've been waiting to talk about this for a while, because there's a very important point to be made.
Now the 3-1. Popped him up to center field. Hamilton started back, now comes on. The ball way up there, and Hamilton dropped the ball. In to score is Chris. In to score is Drew. Cespedes puts the brakes on at second, and the A's take a 7-5 lead on a dropped fly ball by Josh Hamilton.
After discussing how close the Texas Rangers came to winning the 2011 World Series last week, I feel bad picking on them again, but there's a point I want to make about that dropped fly ball by Josh Hamilton, who, of course, had his issues and then revived his career first with Cincinnati and then with Texas. Okay, so he misses a fly ball. Texas, who led the division for like 186 days in 2012, blow the division title by losing to the A's three in a row to end the season. The A's, that was actually the winning runs that scored on that play. But the point I want to make is, back in the old days, and I'm not saying that, you know, we should go back to everything from, you know, 1910 or whatever, but back in the old days, they used to call stuff like that boner. So it would be like Merkel's boner, Snodgrass's boner. I know that there were some after 1912. Snodgrass was the 1912 World Series, but we need more boners in modern day baseball. I mean, Brant Brown dropping a fly ball in left field. Yeah, everybody, you know, who's a Cubs fan hated him then, but honestly, wouldn't it make you feel better if it was called Brant Brown's boner? I really think we should consider bringing back boners into the world of sports. Our host for Worldwide, our Tony Schiavone, who's been known to talk about a boner or two on his podcast alongside David Crockett, and they are very fond of using the term the Major League of Professional Wrestling, which, for whatever reason, every time they say the Major League of Professional Wrestling, I immediately think of the movie Major League and that there's going to be some sort of I asked Joe Boot to come moment. But anyway, instead of Joe Boo and all that, we get news that the Russians, Nikita Koloff, Crusher Khrushchev, and Ivan Koloff are the new six-man tag team champions, so saith David Crockett. But remember, He did that worldwide show from 1988 where he announced that Larry Zbyszko was the new television champion, and he completely screwed up because he meant to say Western State Heritage title, or he meant to say that Mike Rotundo was the new television champion. They did win those titles earlier in October against what feels like a really thrown-together six-man team of Manny Fernandez, who is perfectly fine, Sam Houston, who I've always seen as a little too frail, and Buzz Tyler, who I never quite sure what to make of him. He sounds like a children's like superhero character, and then again, I'm probably thinking of Buzz Lightyear. So we get the sounds of the song Rock and Roll is King, which can only mean one thing, the Rock and Roll Express on their way down. When it comes to Electric Light Orchestra songs, I don't know if that's in my top three necessarily. I like Fire on High. That's probably my favorite ELO song. And then Evil Woman would rank second. I don't know. Fire on High, you know, the part with the long instrumental in the middle, it's burned into my brain because at every freaking event at the Fleet Center in Boston for like the first 2 or 3 years that it opened, they would play this montage of the building being built and they would have that song. And it's just fried in my brain forever. Interesting little production. I don't know if you want to call it a gaffe, but it is certainly something they try to avoid these days, where the camera guy at ringside who is there to carry the Rock and Roll Express, capture the Rock and Roll Express coming to the ring, is waving them in like he's the third base coach or whatever, and they finally do make their way out. Ricky Morton doing a Canadian Destroyer over WrestleMania weekend actually kind of redeemed that move, which is so overdone, I think. But when Ricky Morton does it, it's a little bit different, I think. I mean, think of these two guys. Okay, yeah, they're up there. They're a little long in the tooth, but they're capable of having so many goddamn dream matches against, you know, modern teams, against whoever on the independents. I mean, you'd almost think WWE would bring them in for more little one-off things. Like, I seem to recall them doing that for the Starrcade deal they did. I want to say it was either 2017 or maybe it was last year. I can't remember. I can't keep everything straight that they're doing. But what's funny to me is in this match, they are taking on their heel counterparts, the Rock and Roll RPMs. So, somewhat confusing. I remember in the wrestling magazines being very confused, thinking that the Rock and Roll Express and the Rock and Roll RPMs were the same thing. And it's a shame that they couldn't all end up in the same place as the Rockers at the same time. And then maybe the Southern Rockers at a certain point, they could all have like one of those WrestleMania tag team matches where you get four teams and it all feels completely pointless. Rock and Roll RPMs, I believe I covered them. I think they were on the Pro Wrestling USA show, Tommy Lane and Mike Davis. As we start out, Robert Gibson actually gets both of the RPMs in the corner and he monkey flips the first one and Ricky Morton sneaks in and monkey flips the other one. So fun little sequence there. And they mentioned the upcoming cage match at Starrcade with the Russians for the World Tag Team titles. Spoiler alert, the Rock and Rolls would capture the titles at that event. The first thing you notice watching this show is how loud the crowd is, just yelling, rock and roll, rock and roll. To which I'm wondering, well, actually, that does, again, refer to both teams here. It's like the weird cousin of that thing where the crowd does the USA chant, only it's Bret Hart in the ring against the heel, and he's Canadian. I remember Jesse Ventura was like the only guy with the guts to point out, like, yeah, Bret Hart's Canadian, this chant makes no sense. Back to the RPMs, they kind of float between various promotions, but primarily in the South, although they did appear in the AWA in 1988 at Super Clash 3 alongside Cactus Jack. I think I've mentioned, trivia question, Cactus Jack's first pay-per-view, or Mick Foley's first pay-per-view, is in the AWA. Here they are in JCP 1985. They spent most of their time in Memphis from 86 through into 88, but they did have a stopover in World Class in 1987. Not exactly the greatest place to be at that particular moment in time. The RPMs end up running into each other because Morton does a drop down just your general heel bumpkins or whatever, and then the double drop kick by Ricky and Robert ends up finishing off the rock and roll RPMs in this one. And the crowd, like I said, they are insane for all of this. I mean, this is the Rock and Roll Express pretty much at the peak of their powers. This is like the Beatles playing Shea Stadium in 1964. Again, I'm not entirely sure where this was taped exactly, because for this worldwide, it's hard to discern any results, because I couldn't find a Rock and Roll Express versus the Rock and Roll RPMs match from October of 85, but it's really not important. It's just indicative of how well JCP is doing at this moment in time leading up to Starrcade 85.
From Ward is punched on by Zanin and drilled right back along, and a chance now. It's brought back on by Knubel, moving up front. Knubel has shot, fought off into the rebound, they score!
I need to be careful because this could provoke a multi-front rant. The Capitals Game 7 overtime winner against the Bruins in 2012. One of the most bullshit overtime goals ever scored, because if you look at it now, basically Mike Knubel skates into the crease, makes contact with Tim Thomas, and then they just shove the puck in from there. There's no way in hell that counts under today's regime where they actually review goaltender interference. Unless, of course, Toronto is the one that scores the goal, and then in which case they just count it because they're calling Toronto for the review. Yeah, few people made stupid racist remarks about Joel Ward being African-American or African-Canadian. I can't remember if he's American or Canadian, scoring the goal. Because apparently in 2012, we did not quite understand the concept of there are a lot more stupid people on Twitter than quite frankly, all the rest of us. And I don't know. That series was so annoying. It was the first series in NHL history that went to seven games, and all seven games were decided by one goal. It was just very irritating, like, the whole way through, because the Capitals that one year were playing this boring defensive style completely against the type that they had established in the years before that. I don't know. I'm mad. I got to move on. And what's going to make me feel better than an Arn Anderson promo? And you got to say, good old Marty Lundy is all over this show, like Marty McFly is all over Back to the Future. And he's got a couple of things with him. The television title belt and a new hat. Arn Anderson is totally like Malibu Stacy. Like, but now he's got a new hat. And yes, one of those things actually does belong to him. It's the fedora-looking type hat that he has on, rather than the television belt, because he doesn't have that yet, because Dusty Rhodes had just vacated it due to the injury that gave him hard times and all that. Arn Anderson would win the eventual tournament that they had for the television title, but that doesn't finalize until January of 86, so we're still a ways from that. So now Arn is going to give us a lesson in the difference between having and wanting.
David Crockett, there are those people in this world that have things. That's AA, Tully Blanchard, United States Heavyweight Champion, Ole Anderson, one half the National Tag Team Champions, and my cousin, Ric Flair, the World Heavyweight Champion. We're the people that have things. Then you have people that want things. You got Dusty Rhodes, you got Magnum T.A., you got this muscle head that's just come on the scene, Billy Jack Haynes. They want things. But the difference, David Crockett, is when you get hurt, you get injured, you got to put a little icy hot on it, you got to wrap it up, you got to tape it, and then you got to go for it. The fact is, I've got the guts, I've got the determination, and I do have the world television title.
I will never get tired of listening to Arn Anderson promos. Definitely top 10 in the history of wrestling, possibly top 5, because he certainly gets overshadowed by always being associated with Ric Flair, who is certainly up there as well. I love the pregnant pause after he said AA. I mean, you have to put in AA MCO because of the old commercial. I mean, I was just looking for, like, Amco commercials, like, the old ones, like, oh, I'm going to use this one with Claude Akins, because he played Sheriff Lobo in the Misadventures of Sheriff Lobo back in 79. But, yeah, Arn, he's definitely on the way up. You know, looking at him when he came in March of 85, he's wearing the Yankees hat at that time, and now he's kind of moved over to a fedora, so he's trying out a number of different things. I don't know if he had issues with the whole bald spot thing, but the thing never really advanced too far. He always kind of looked the same pretty much the entire time he was there. So up next, we have Jimmy Valiant and his giant ass, and we don't really know who he's going up against because it's a Jimmy Valiant match, and having the normal ring announcement and all that stuff is it's just not going to happen. David Crockett, he lets us know that KDNL in St. Louis is now televising NWA worldwide from Jim Crockett Promotions. This is the weak ABC affiliate that I spoke of when I did the Wrestling at the Chase show, WWF style, from 1984, about 10 or 12 episodes ago. Go check that out in the archives. Valiant in the yellow and black, which kind of makes me wonder if he's the secret third Killer Bee or something. I think he's a hell of a lot better than Brian Blair. I mean, that's for sure. And before we even really get this thing started in earnest, he runs the poor guy into the ring post. And David Crockett, you'd think that calling that, you know, where you just send a guy into the ring post is simple. But why does David Crockett can take something as simple as that and get it wrong?
The Boogeyman. The one and only Jimmy Valiant rams him into that turnbuckle, the post, and he goes down. Valiant now has him.
Generally, I like announcers who will get at least a little bit excited about stuff. David Crockett would go overboard sometimes. I mean, not to the point where he was yelling Mamma Mia every 35 seconds like Mauro Ranallo does, and it's like the reason why I can't watch NXT TV. But anyway, yeah, he sends him into the ring post, which he calls the turnbuckle. He does correct himself, but then and then he goes down. I'm like, no, the guy actually stayed on his feet before Jimmy threw him back into the ring. And then he just kind of puts a shin to the guy's throat, and his shoulders are on the mat, but the referee is not counting because this is Tommy Young's six-time referee of the year, as Jim Ross would always remind us later on in the decade. And nothing is going on, and they go on about St. Louis again. And this is probably more important than talking about yet another Jimmy Valiant match where literally nothing is happening because he locks in a freaking chin lock. And this Jim Crockett Promotions was going to St. Louis, and they were going to run a show at the arena, which is where the St. Louis Blues were playing at that point in time. And they did it the night after Starrcade on November 29th, and the WWF ran St. Louis on the same night. So I think it would be appropriate if I did a comparison of the two cards. First, here's the JCP show, which drew 3,600 to the arena. It's their debut there. Tully Blanchard over Art Cruz. National heavyweight champion Buddy Landell and Terry Taylor go to a 20-minute time limit draw. Jimmy Valiant and superstar Billy Graham defeated Bobby Eaton and Dennis Condrey via disqualification, so the Midnight Express. Jerry Blackwell defeated Tarzan Goto, substituting for Mr. Pogo. Goto for Pogo. The six-man tag team champions Koloff, Nikita Koloff, Ivan Koloff, and Crusher Khrushchev defeated Billy Jack Haynes and the Rock and Roll Express. United States champion Magnum TA pinned NWA television champion Arn Anderson to win the title after the bout. Magnum vacated the belt and gave it to Jim Crockett Jr. So I guess they have that tournament, and then Arn wins it after that point. And then finally, Dusty Rhodes fought Ric Flair to a double disqualification in which Rhodes is billed as the NWA World Champion because he had come out of Starrcade with the belt, and you don't overturn the decision until the TV eventually airs. So that's the JCP show. The WWF ran the Kiel Auditorium and drew 4,300, so a slight edge to them there, but I'm not sure I would pick this card over the JCP card. Lanny Poffo defeated Rene Goulet. King Tonga defeated Terry Gibbs. Mike Rotundo, now solo with the departure of Barry Windham, defeated Les Thornton. Terry Funk defeated the Junkyard Dog by countout. Well, maybe Terry Funk will get me to go there. WWF Tag Team Champions Dream Team, Valentine and Beefcake, defeated the Killer Bees. Pedro Morales defeated Moondog Spot. And Andre the Giant defeated King Kong Bundy via disqualification. I think I would go with the JCP show, mainly because I think that there's a little bit more there. But, you know, a little bit more high-profile stuff. But there are a few good things on the WWF show. It's just those first three matches, there's not a whole lot to see. Unless, you know, I might be afraid of King Tonga. I might, you know, maybe show up there and then leave after King Tonga's match and head over to the NWA show. I'm not entirely sure how close together the Kiel and the arena were, I think they were fairly close to each other. And this match, by the way, with Valiant, has gone like 2.5 minutes of him just kind of laying on the guy with like a chin lock and nerve holds, and like he's like alternating, and then Valiant grabs the ropes, and Tommy Young doesn't even make him break it immediately the way you would, like, you know, Mike Rotundo grabbing the ropes when he's IRS and has a guy in abdominal stretch. And I'm just like, what the hell is this? And finally, he hits the elbow drop to mercifully finish this match. And I was thinking of things that I would rather have happen than watch this particular Jimmy Valiant squash match again. And I'm thinking back to the first night that I had my new cat, Noki, in the house here, and she threw up on me at one point, which was okay because I was doing laundry, so it just meant I could just take off the pants that I was wearing and put them in the washing machine. I would rather have the cat throw up on me than watch this Jimmy Valiant match ever again in my life. Burn it and send it straight to hell.
Then bottom nine, a runner on first with 2 outs. Jim Johnson facing Jared Saltalamacchia, representing the tying run. And Boston down to their final strike when Saltalamacchia launches one high and deep to left. Would it clear the monster? Yes, it does. It would tie the game up at 6 on the 2-run home run by Saltalamacchia.
Even though I was rooting for the Orioles, that home run probably saved me from a very bad faux pas, because I had my foot out in the aisle and I was basically going to sprint out of the stadium so that I could get home. But that would have been a real faux pas, because it was actually the client that I worked on for my employer at that time was at the game with us, and I was able to go because I had worked on that client for a number of years. So it would have been bad had I just run out of there, and we had really good seats, and the home run ties the game. Fortunately, the Orioles ended up winning the game in extra innings. I think it was 10 innings, so it didn't go too much longer than that. Now, unlike Elaine Benes, I actually went to lengths to conceal my Orioles fandom, which was not, you know, necessarily apparent to everybody at that time. I don't think my mother really figured it out until 2014, when I actually traveled to see the Orioles in Chicago. You know, that kind of got the message through, like, oh, you're actually traveling to see this team. And for whatever reason, I just didn't want to rock the boat and have that be like all the questions or whatever. But now I can finally reveal to you why I am a Baltimore Orioles fan. If you think back to last week and how much I hated Adrian Gonzalez and other members of that 2011 Red Sox team, I still loved Terry Francona, the manager, even though he'd kind of lost the team. And the way he was fired and then smeared as like this drug-addled womanizer on his way out the door. And the Red Sox had done that so many times with like all these stars that leave. And then, oh, all of a sudden they're horrible people with Nomar, with Mo Vaughn. The list goes on and on. Even Pedro Martinez, which really pissed me off back when he left before the 2005 season, especially since the guys that they brought in as replacements, David Wells and Matt Clement, neither one of them worked out. At least Pedro would have been good for that 2005 season. It's not like the Red Sox needed to be cheap. So why do I all of a sudden not like the Red Sox at that point? Well, it's a function of the people on the team. And as I'm thinking about it, I'm like, I'm not even really enjoying baseball. And you can figure out how much I enjoy the sport. I mean, I go to minor league games all the time. I even, you know, will go to Fenway Park for non-Orioles games a couple times a year. Stuff like that. So why the Baltimore Orioles? Well, it's as simple as this. I was always a fan of Adam Jones, but he was not the reason why I became an Orioles fan. And I have one witness to this who sat next to me at work, and I pulled up an article from the Boston Herald that announced that the Baltimore Orioles were changing their uniforms and they were restoring the proper cartoon bird hat that they had had from 1966 through 1988. And they put on the ornithological bird, or however it's pronounced, that I never liked as much as that. And I thought I looked at the cartoon bird and I said, you know what? I'm in. This is something I want to be a part of. Now, remember, at the time, they had had 14 consecutive losing seasons. So it's not like I was jumping on some bandwagon there. It just so happened that oh, they had their first winning season since 1997 and get into the playoffs and win the wild card game. But that'll be another highlight I have coming up. So, yeah, while it does sound stupid that I changed teams in part because of a hat change, I'm much happier for it, even if, you know, they lost 115 games last year. But, hey, losing builds character, I guess, or at least that's what the Peanuts comic strips on baseball had taught me. And that must mean I have a lot of character.
When we talk about the Major League of Wrestling, the very best in wrestling, we're talking about the wrestlers brought to you by Jim Crockett Promotions. And let's bring in one of the top stars right now. One half of the National Tag Team Champions, Arn Anderson.
Because he makes so many appearances on this show, it's allowed me to reflect on Arn Anderson a little bit more than usual. And I was, in thinking about it, in the, you know, the poisonous political culture that we live in today, I think that Arn Anderson would have been the perfect post-partisan president that we could have had and agreed on.
Who's president of the United States in 1985?
Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan? The actor?
It's a very simple platform. He's loyal to his allies. We know that. He means what he says, and he's very straightforward with it. And I would watch any State of the Union or White House Oval Office address that Arn wanted to give. It wouldn't annoy me in the least, even if it was interrupting my favorite program, unless he cuts into overtime of a playoff hockey game, in which case it's different. He doesn't outright lie. Yeah, heels lie, but you can always see like a kernel of truth of what he's saying. And most importantly, Arn Anderson has stood up to the Russians. He has experience in that realm. So I would actually trust him on foreign policy. I would need to know a little bit more about how he feels about the budget. Not entirely sure where Arn stands on entitlement reform, but hey, I'll put that aside. Now, the Four Horsemen are forming around this time. And unlike Austin 316 says, I just kicked your ass or whooped your ass or whatever the hell it was at King of the Ring 96. There's no exact moment where, oh yeah, this is where the term Four Horsemen was coined. I mean, there are a couple of points where it is mentioned. So it is entirely possible that this is the first reference to a Four Horsemen, or at least in the top 3 to 5.
And why will you not recognize me as a world television champion?
I think the fans know the circumstances around that belt, Arn, and I...
Do you have any concept of law in theory?
No, no.
Okay, one thing about law. Possession is 9/10 of the law, and as you see, I am possessor. Now then, are you man enough to take this away from me?
No, no, not at all.
See anybody standing around man enough to take this away from me?
Well...
Okay, now when you talk about Jim Crockett Promotions, you're talking about the Four Horses. The four people that make things happen. You're talking about Double A, Ole Anderson, Tully Blanchard, and Ric Flair. So now then, any time one of the four, all of the four, or half of the four head your way, St. Louis, do whatever you have to get there, because you're going to see the very best at what we do, and that is professional wrestling. Bye-bye. It's been your pleasure. I'm out of here.
Now, when you hear the term Four Horsemen, you would probably think of Ole Arn, Flair, Tully Blanchard, or any of the other incarnations that would come later. But obviously, there are other uses of the term as well that predate that, going all the way back to the Bible, Revelations chapter 6, verses 1 through 8.
It's in Revelations, people!
But if you go back earlier in the 20th century, you can find other uses of the term, such as in the 1930s, there was a block of four conservative justices on the Supreme Court of the United States that were kind of blocking the New Deal agenda of FBR. The justices Pierce Butler, James Clark McReynolds, George Sutherland, and Willis Van Devanter. I don't know which one is Flair and which one is Arn out of that group, but they were there, and that was what led FDR to try and pack the court and expand it out from 9 to and adding additional justices and all that. But more famous than that, back in the 20s, more specifically the 1923-24 Notre Dame football team had a backfield of these four guys, Jim Crowley, Elmer Layden, Don Miller, and Henry Stuhldreher. I don't know how to say his name, but a much celebrated backfield coached by Newt Rockne, who my wife thought was a black man when she saw a picture of him at Notre Dame, which I thought was funny because it was a guy coaching Notre Dame in the year 1929. So it would have been highly unlikely for that to happen. The term Four Horsemen for the football players was coined by the sports writer Grantland Rice, who, of course, became the namesake for Grantland when Bill Simmons formed that. Because what we needed was 75,000-word think pieces about Beverly Hills 90210. But Grantland Rice was known for his prose, and I think it's fitting because Arn Anderson, also known for his prose in a verbal sense. So up next, fittingly, we have Tully Blanchard, probably one of the few guys who would be capable of following an Arn Anderson promo like that. Baby Doll is by his side, and she is dressed, well, let's just put it this way. She's got one of those hats on, like she's Blossom's friend or something like that. She ain't no Jenna Von Oy, I'll tell you that. But somebody on Twitter was talking about Tully and saying that he was the best at the simple act of holding a championship belt. And that was one of those tweets, and I wish I could remember who it was, that I wish I could like multiple times because it was such a good point.
You know, it's very evident that St. Louis, Missouri has become accustomed to the absolute best in professional sports. Bringing to mind right now the Cardinals. They're on top of the world. Well, I tell you what, Jim Crockett Promotions, the greatest wrestling promoter in all of the world today, is bringing professional wrestling at its finest to St. Louis. All throughout history, the wrestling world revolved around St. Louis, Missouri. If you were somebody in professional wrestling, you were right here in St. Louis.
This goes back to that thing, not only on the Wrestling at the Chase WWF show that I did, but the AWA show from 1984, where St. Louis is this area that everybody sort of coveted, because when Sam Muchnick was in charge of the NWA, it literally was the center of the wrestling universe in a way, like Tully was saying. A lot of that had to do with Lou Thesz, and that went back long number of years before that. Now, as for the sports teams, yeah, the Cardinals were in the World Series in 1985. Of course, on the day this aired, it was Game 6, and that was where they got screwed on that umpiring call at first base.
Little squibber to the right side. Worrell races over to cover. The throw doesn't get him. Worrell got to the bag in an argument here, and here comes Herzog amongst the other quartet.
So yeah, pretty clearly the baseball Cardinals got screwed in the World Series on that one. I have to say baseball Cardinals because there's also the football Cardinals still in St. Louis at that point on their way to a very mediocre 5-11 season in the NFC East, where they were with Dallas, and New Orleans and Atlanta were in the NFC West, because the NFL cared not for your definitions of geography because they had their own little system. The St. Louis Blues, on the other hand, well, they were not a great team. They had recovered from their abandonment by their owners, Ralston Purina, which, by the way, the fact that a dog food company literally abandoned a sports team, I don't know, kind of, it does strike me as a little strange, but they recovered from that to make the conference finals of the NHL playoffs that year, falling to Calgary in 7 games. They had a miracle comeback in game 6 of the conference final to win in overtime. So yeah, St. Louis, pretty good sports town, legendary wrestling town going back a number of years, but I still can't figure out a reason why I would ever have to go there. Other than that time in 2008, I guess, when I was in Kansas City, thought about driving across the state to St. Louis for the Springsteen show that night, and didn't do it, stayed back, got drunk, went to a Royals-Tigers game, which featured 3 sacrifice flies and a Miguel Cabrera home run that went off an automobile in left field that I guess they were giving away. So, I don't know, I guess it came out even, but I still ain't never been to St. Louis. Even though Take On Me by A-ha fell from number 1 on that week in 1985, it's a much better bumper than Saving All My Love for You by Whitney Houston, which ascended to the top spot on the American Top 40. I don't know. Also, Take On Me, probably the greatest music video ever for its use of, you know, the drawings and all that sort of hoo-ha. So anyway, up next we have the Russians, Nikita Koloff, Ivan Koloff, and Crusher Khrushchev. You're probably expecting me to say something about Gorbachev and Reagan, Geneva Summit, all that. And that's not till November of 85. I'm much more interested in the other side, which is Sam Houston, Brady Boone, and a fella by the name of Stoney Burke. Now, if you take just Houston and Brady Boone, that's like the WWF jobber super team of 88 or whatever. And this other dude, Stoney Burke, who sounds like something out of the Flintstones when they would always Stoney Kurt Rock and all that sort of stuff. I actually had a, well, quasi-relative named Stoney. And I say quasi because he was the son of the second woman that my paternal grandfather married. But what I mainly remember him for is the dude smoked like an absolute chimney, and he looked like David Lander from Laverne and Shirley playing the role of Squiggy. Because I remember him wearing like a leather thing like one of the two times that I saw him. This was brought up in conversation with my wife because I have no idea what happened to those people, like the, or even the woman that my grandfather married. I assume that she passed away because she would probably be in her late 90s, I think now. But I don't know if that makes me a horrible person or not. It's not like any of us kept in touch or anything like that. So anyway, as we get started, Brady Boone, who's very new into the business, he turns up in JCP in 1985. So this is very much the start of his career. He's running the ropes rather shittily here. I mean, even Kelly Kelly, if she was even alive at this point, would be kind of looking at it and being like, hey, that's pretty lousy. He gets caught laid out in the corner where they just kind of lay him on the top of the ropes in the corner. And the Russians do a neat thing with a rotation of double teams where they just wail on a guy, and the guy who had just tagged in would immediately tag out, utilize the five count. I'm sure Jesse Ventura would be pointing this out. But eventually Boone is able to tag to Sam Houston, who's in versus Nikita Koloff. And Nikita is not at his peak in terms of, you know, how big he is. But anytime you have a guy like that standing next to Sam Houston, it's a huge difference. It's like comparing yourself with one of those stick figures you see on the back of the crossover SUV or whatever that seems to have become a thing in the last 10 years. I don't quite understand. I guess it's for anybody who has kids, I would assume it's for that. But Khrushchev, when he gets in there, he puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran who used to be known as Barry Darsow. But then Sam Houston misses the charge in the corner, which I will admit, I've been critical of Sam Houston for his body type. He's very good at that hope spot that then eventually fails, where he just gets wiped out afterwards. And Crusher gets him up in a big military press slam. And yes, the future Repo Man smash, always very sneaky strong. You never think of him as a power guy. I've pointed out him slamming Big Boss Man and Akeem in succession at SummerSlam 89 as kind of a cool thing. Houston does a leapfrog and then hits a drop kick and tags out to Stoney Burke, who, for whatever reason, just because his name is Stoney, I've labeled him the number three guy in this team. But I'm quite frankly just glad that he's not going to be Lou Winston in this one, the tag worker from last week's show that I covered from Memphis, who never even got into the freaking match. Well, he does summarily get his ass beaten as there's a blind tag to Crusher Khrushchev, who hits a huge clothesline out of nowhere. I guess he didn't see that coming or whatever. And for fun, after they pick up the win, the Russians just beat the crap out of every guy on the other team. As the crowd is going absolutely, you know, crazy for this, or waiting for somebody to run in. But yes, this is a very hot-ass crowd. And pretty good squash match by the Russians with Nikita and Crusher Khrushchev doing all of the work. But hey, like I said, I feel that Ivan Koloff is the best Soviet heel of all time. So every now and then, he deserves a chance to kick back, being the senior statesman of the group.
Two out. Fly ball left field.
That's it.
Nate McLouth is there. And the magical season of the Baltimore Orioles continues. The first ever American League wild card game goes to Baltimore. 5-1 over the Rangers.
I should point out, to go back to Hamilton's boner from earlier, that Texas would not have even had to play that game if they had won any of those games against Oakland the last three of the season. Although I suppose it could have been any game that they had lost over the course of the season. Nevertheless, miraculous by the Orioles that entire year. 29-9 in one-run games, which is completely non-sustainable, but hey, weird things happen. They started Joe Saunders in that game against Yu Darvish, a hotshot rookie at the time for the Texas Rangers. And I remember the guy who was my one witness to becoming an Orioles fan, he's of Japanese descent, so he was a huge Yu Darvish fan. And I just remember flashing a huge smile at him the day after that game and just not saying anything. Because what could you really say? I mean, it was completely unexpected. Of course, Jim Johnson, he loads the bases in the ninth inning with a four-run lead and decides to make things interesting. But, you know, that was Jim Johnston. You know, he didn't make music for WWE, but he did save 50 games two consecutive years for the Orioles. So up next, we have David Crockett, and he is joined by a most interesting character in Billy Jack Haynes. This is during his very brief run in Jim Crockett Promotions, as he was prone to having some brief stays in territories for varying different reasons. This run in JCP ended shortly after Starrcade 85 because he was not happy with whatever payout he got for that show. I don't really have any of the information of what guys got at that time. I don't think that that's out there. But it's always interesting when Billy Jack, certainly in the middle of the card at this time, when the mid-card guys have an issue with what they're making. I mean, yeah, when it's a main eventer like the Ultimate Warrior at SummerSlam 91, it gets even more attention just because of the weird contractual thing and how it eventually all came out in court anyway. Now, on a list of people in this world that I would not want to interrupt, I'm pretty sure that Billy Jack Haynes would be on that list of people that if he's talking, I don't necessarily want to jump in and start challenging him. But you have to remember, this is the Arn Anderson show here today. So he's just going to strut on through and he's going to do whatever the hell he damn well pleases.
What I've seen Ric Flair do to Dusty Rhodes, he'll hang on to himself. But this here Arn Anderson, I don't know what his problem is. You musclehead, you've run through everybody in the NWA, but now you got to the measuring stick. Jim Crockett Promotions, Worldwide Wrestling, is the measuring stick. And if you want to get up here and butt heads with the big boys like myself, Ole Anderson, Tully Blanchard, and Ric Flair, you better get a grocery bag of vitamins and move you a cot in the gym. Hard Rock, you are in trouble, Daddy.
For me, the most hilarious part of this is that after Arn says his piece there, he just sort of walks away, and Billy Jack is kind of nonplussed, like, hey, hey, and just kind of yells at him. He doesn't, like, run after him like you would expect, you know, a brawl on the set of an interview, you know, during a wrestling event. I mean, that's what you're expecting. It's just so weird how this sort of comes off.
Listen, Mr. Crockett, I come down here to the NWA because that's where the action's at. Now, worldwide TV, everybody seen, he took the belt, the TV belt away from Dusty Rhodes. Ric Flair breaks his ankle. I'm telling you what, Dusty, I'm here to back you up. I know all the fans here are going to back us up, and we're going to be here, and we're going to kick some B-U-T-T. You got it?
Spelling out butt like that, B-U-T-T, sounds like he's saying beauty, or at least that's the way it hit my ear. I don't know. I know there was a recent interview with Billy Jack Haynes that became somewhat antagonistic from the interviewer to him, which, I mean, you have to understand who your subject is. Like on the military industrial suplex interview of Billy Jack Haynes that was out a couple of months ago on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, it was extremely well done, 2 hours. I know that the only thing is he couldn't get anything out of Billy Jack. Tom couldn't get anything out of Billy Jack about World Class. For some reason, he didn't want to talk about that, like Bobby Heenan changing the subject about when Andre the Giant was being reinstated. But if you want to hear more about Billy Jack, I think that's definitely the place to go. And also, ProWrestlingOnly.com, where you can explore other podcasts like Strong Style Story, This Week in Wrestling, Worldcast, of course, in the middle of 1983, covering World Class Championship Wrestling, out on the feed this week. And you got match reviews, features, retrospectives, reviews of wrestling books. In fact, there was a, I don't know, we took group perspectives of the experience at WrestleMania 35 because a lot of people went to it. I probably should have plugged this last week when I did a little write-up for it. Just kind of the number one takeaway for the weekend. And I talked about, you know, the people that I met and how it was all just sort of a chill and great scene. So that is on Pro Wrestling Only right now. But you can also see wrestler appearances in non-wrestling TV shows, movies, and more. Join the conversation by signing up at the PWO Forums online for over a decade. With over 2,000 registered members, the message board is a vibrant community on its own. Whether you want to talk about a specific match in the match discussion archive, take a deep dive in microscope form, discuss more general topics from wrestling past and present, discuss Peter's inability to do a live read, you know, in any sort of usual fashion, check all that out at ProWrestlingOnly.com. And yes, there is a podcast form where you can weigh in on my live read style, which is just way too by the seat of my pants. So up next, we have, I just got to go right into this because this is incredible. Is David Crockett there again? I kind of wish Tony was doing more of the interviews here. A little too much David Crockett on this show. And he's got the Boogie Woogie Man, Jimmy Valiant, who, you know, see a little bit earlier. But now, Jimmy, he must understand that people are after his hair because he's got a hat on, but he also has what appears to be the bird from the Fruit Loops box on there. Like, he's got Toucan Sam on the top of his head.
Listen, a boogeyman show feel high today, baby. You know, all the street people, we together, baby. I'm talking about Bad to the Bone. I'm talking about Big Mama. I'm talking about the racket. And I'm talking about Boogie Woogie. You know, there's one street person, a street lady, David, has been following me around for the last 4 or 5 weeks. And brother, she's been coming in the ring and knocking out one of those rock, one of those express, midnight express style jack. And I sure would like to see her come on the side of the street.
Having watched a lot of Jimmy Valiant stuff from the 80s, it's no surprise to me that he's actually high. Although, on the flip side, if I was to pick a wrestler from the 80s, even just, you know, Crockett, a wrestler to get high with, to smoke grass with, I think Jimmy Valiant would be very high on that list. I mean, that'd be akin to doing it with Willie Nelson on the roof of the White House, which, by the way, is an actual thing that happened when Jimmy Carter was president. So they show a clip of the Midnight Express running in and just beating down Jimmy Valiant at one point. No haircut or anything like that. They're not interested in any of that sort of stuff. So that woman that he is referring to for the street, which, by the way, all I can think is Jimmy Valiant is Jesus and this woman is Mary Magdalene, but this street lady that he is referring to is actually the future Miss Atlanta Lively, which is Ronnie Garvin, future world champion Ronnie Garvin, mind you. I kind of always think back to that Garvin and Ric Flair feud of the mid to late 80s and just think it was all entirely about which dude looked better in drag. Because Flair at that uncensored 95, I think it was, where he was dressed up as a woman. You know, who's more attractive, Ronnie Garvin in drag or Ric Flair in drag? Don't be afraid to explore your sexuality and at least have a take on something.
Tell us something. If you are watching this station, Jack, if you are watching this station, street lady, listen to the boogeyman. If you want to come on to my side, if you want to join the forces with the street people, please, write your station or write President Reagan. Do something. Come and see me, baby. We're going to do it together. Hurrah, hurrah, hurrah. Who's right there, right there?
So you hear David Crockett at the end yelling. That's because Jimmy Valiant has decided to kiss him. Because that's what you want, a dude with hepatitis just laying a giant kiss on you like that. I mean, God knows, you know, what's going on in that mouth. Who knows? The notion also, being somebody who has read a lot of Ronald Reagan diary books that he kept during his presidency, where there'd be like entries for each day, I don't recall reading anything where he got a letter from Miss Atlanta Lively or Jimmy Valiant trying to bring everybody together. Although that would have been funny had somebody actually written the President of the United States. Of course, these days, the President of the United States is a WWE Hall of Famer for whatever the hell that is. But yeah, can you imagine Reagan like opening the letter like he's talking to Nancy?
Well, Mommy, maybe we should help out this Jimmy Valiant guy in part of our southern strategy to court rural white voters in the South.
Nah, I don't do as good of a Reagan as I do Ross Perot or some other guys. But by the way, the Back to the Future thing where they say, who's the president of the United States in 85? Ronald Reagan. And then Doc Brown says, who's the first lady? Jane Wyman? anachronism because he had been married to Nancy Davis for several years by 1955 and had divorced Jane Wyman at some point in the 40s. So I feel the need, I should point that out.
Yeah, remember that guy you had trouble with on the beach?
Oh yeah, King Karate.
Yeah, he was my ex-boyfriend.
Well, that's good to know.
I'm not just playing that because the show Cobra Kai released season 2 on YouTube TV earlier this week, although I have yet to actually watch that show, and I know Steve Bennett is going to be pissed off when he hears me say that. Like, how have you never watched this, given, you know, that you're a Karate Kid fan and all that? Okay, fine. So yes, King Karate, which in a wrestling context can only bring one person to mind, and it is, oh dear God, superstar Billy Graham is back in my life once again. It makes me think that there should have been, is there an outtake of, I am familiar with a lot, some of the deleted scenes and, you know, stuff that never made it in from The Karate Kid. Was Superstar Billy Graham like a ringer dude from the All Valley tournament that Daniel dispatched earlier? Kind of like that fat Cobra Kai guy who loses, you know, the one who gets like kicked in the gut, and then they cut to Johnny talking to Kreese, and Johnny's like, yeah, that guy's fat. Like, you can basically just read his lips. But I do have some good news to report, as Karate Billy Graham is no more. He has gone back to the tie-dye guy. So apparently he did lose the title of King Karate at some point in time. He's a baby face. Everybody loves him. He's going against Paul Jones's army because Jimmy Valiant can't do everything all the time. They say that he is decked out in fuchsia, which, in terms of the color, but to me, it looks like the dude is wearing velvet pants, which doesn't make any sense to me, because a guy, you wear whatever you want, quite frankly. I'm not sure a guy anywhere can pull off velvet pants. Now, a woman could pull off velvet pants pretty much any time, any place, in my opinion. But, by the way, he's taking on Mark Fleming in this one, and I'm going to try to get through this thing without cutting a rap, as they tell us that we're going to find out about Dusty Rhodes and his injury coming up. Which, when he said, going to find out about Dusty Rhodes, like, oh, does Baby Doll have another envelope that she wants to blackmail him with? No, that's a couple of years down the road. Literally, nothing happens in this match. He wins it with the Argentine backbreaker. So, I just did not take any notes about this match at all. And I feel like you might be cheated if I don't do my usual superstar Billy Graham thing. So hit it. Obi Trice, real name, no gimmicks. Two trailer park girls go round the outside, round the outside, round the outside. Two trailer park girls go round the outside, round the outside, round the outside. Ooh. Guess who's back? Back again. Shady's back. Tell a friend. Guess who's back? 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 All right, that's enough for now, because I know that there are more Billy Graham matches out there, so I have to save something for the future.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're here at the Metrolina Orthopedic and Sports Medicine Clinic with Dr. Estwanik. First, Dusty, I want to thank you for letting us come here to find out exactly how long you're going to be out of wrestling.
This segment with Dusty Rhodes at the doctor kind of raises a few questions in kayfabe I have the hat on right now, such as, does Dusty Rhodes get health insurance because he's part of the office of Jim Crockett Promotions as the booker? I would assume not. But who knows? I mean, things back then were a little bit different. I know that health insurance was certainly cheaper. What is his copay at that time if he does have health insurance? Is Dusty Rhodes in the SAG union because he was in the movie The Wrestler back in 1974 and stole the show alongside Dick Murdoch? I don't know why that's the first thing that comes to mind, probably because it's such a political issue in this country. But with all this medical stuff going on, I may need to call Keithy in on this one because, you know, I may need a medical coder for this sort of stuff. So the question is, he was attacked famously by Flair, who had kind of turned on him, because they were allied earlier in 1985, as I covered several episodes ago from the March of 85 worldwide. Dusty and Flair standing side by side, even though Flair is wearing pajamas, which felt really weird, like just like sweatpants I don't know. It was just so weird to see them together between their two Starrcade matches. So Dusty attacked in the Omni. They break his leg, and he's here for treatment. So we have to find out, with Starrcade only a month away, how long is he going to be out? Because these are hard times for Dusty Rhodes.
Well, David, it's been a real secret as to everybody how long we'll be out of wrestling. And since it happened, everybody had different ideas on Dusty Rhodes, what's going to happen to the American Dream. And this is a very important time for me, and this is a time to where I reflect and think about a lot of things that's happened through my life. We're all on a time schedule. And Dr. Aswanek is the best at what he does. That's why I'm here. That's why we're here at his clinic, because he's interested in all type of sports injuries, and he's interested in one man right now, a big old boy from Austin, Texas, Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream. And like my father being a plumber, that's all he knew how to do. Professional wrestling is all I know how to do. I know how to do nothing else. This is my life. And I'm on a time schedule in it, just like he was before he passed away. And I'm not bringing up bad things, but there's an old man up there watching all this. And that's something Dusty Rhodes got to do. And we talked for an hour before you got here about me coming back, when I come back, how do I come back, and what I do. And I told Dr. Swanick that November the 3rd was the day that I was coming back, and he's optimistic about it. Deep down, I guess I am too, but it's something that I'm shooting for, and it's something that I want to do. And the training that I will go through between now and then is only up to him and his equipment and how I come out of it. But November the 3rd is when I want to be back.
I love the outsized Dusty Rhodes that you would see, you know, in those vignettes in the WWF. Doo-doo is good for me, and doo-doo is good for you. Or the stuff on commentary later on, WCW Saturday Night, him openly marking out for El Dandy. And by the way, I'm happy to report that I found the El Dandy singles match against Rey Mysterio Jr. with Dusty Rhodes on commentary, and it was as good as you would think it was. But it's a very interesting tone here, because he's injured, so it's a more somber occasion. He's literally in a doctor's office. So to see him calm and sort of despondent like this, you know, there's a different feeling to it. It's like that Ric Flair interview that, on the World Class show several episodes ago, where he's just this cool, calm, I wouldn't say a killer type, but it just strikes you differently than what you would come to expect from that person. So he says he's going to be back on November 3rd at the Omni. Okay, worry about that in a second, because we hear from the doctor, Dr. Joseph Estwanek, who, well, why don't we hear from him first, and then I'll give you the 411 on this guy.
The problem with any injury of this type is that it's hard to determine exact dates. Generally, with something of this nature, we're talking about 6 weeks or so. Our problem, though, is even if the ankle is or is not ready, can we also get him in shape and continue whatever conditioning programs he's had in the past and not forget Dusty Rhodes just because of his ankle?
I want to know more about this Dusty Rhodes conditioning program from the 80s so that I can go ahead and do the exact opposite, seeing as though I have to lose weight. What was it? Eating cheesesteaks or something? Jesus. So this Dr. Joseph Estwanek guy, believe it or not, even though this is 1985 and he's a doctor on television, he is actually still practicing, at least according to the various, you know, medical websites you can go to, WebMD, Vitals.com has some ratings on him, and it's rather fascinating, although I will, you know, give you the caveat of there's a certain selection bias where somebody who goes online to rate a doctor is probably much more likely to be negative rather than positive. But hey, that's what this show is here for, to let you know about the doctor who operated on Hillbilly Jim's leg, the doctor who is with Dusty Rhodes in this particular promo. Hey, if you're going to cut a promo on NWA Worldwide, I need to find out about you. But this review here from February of 2019, 5 stars. Not Dave Meltzer, by the way. Just had my visit with Dr. Estwanek, and I have to say it was very good. Not only did he take his time, but he listened. Doctors like him are a rare find today. I did not feel rushed, nor did I feel like a number but a person. The office staff was just as nice. Highly recommend him. Now, they had a wait time of 10 minutes, so I think that that's probably a factor as well. But then this next person, also February of 2019, 1 star. Not only was Dr. Estwanek rude, he lacks compassion, is abrasive, and has poor people skills. He appeared scattered and unprepared for the appointment. Any future care from him, for myself or a loved one, would never be an option. I sincerely feel that retirement should be in Dr. Estwanick's very near future. And yeah, the guy has got to be pushing like 75, 80 years old at this point. By the way, that person had a wait time of 45 minutes, and it was one star across the board. But then you got this person who gives him 5 stars from September of 2018, but yet goes on to just rail against him and says, Dr. Estwanick is retired in Cornelius, North Carolina, running a second opinion practice solely for the purpose of taking all OWCP injured workers off workman's comp benefits. Run if OWCP sends you to this man for a second opinion. He will always say the worker's injury has been resolved. For the record, OWCP is Office of Workers' Compensation Programs. And I'll just read one more one-star review from June of 2015. I would never go to him again. His arrogance is only surpassed by his lack of compassion. I wonder if his arrogance is because he was in JCP in 1985. It's like, how many doctors, like, he goes to a convention like, so what do you do? Yeah, I operated on so-and-so. Yeah, I was in Jim Crockett Promotions in 1985 when the territory was at its hottest.
And there's no doubt, David, that I have to do what he tells me. Something that we talked about too also in the last couple of days is what I'm calling the boot. And that is something that is medically sound and is used on different athletes, tennis players and runners and athletes of all kind. And it goes on my foot, will fit inside my boot, my regular boot. We're preparing one for the size of my leg. I'm going to learn how to use it. Learn how to use it well. Learn how to if it's strong enough to do it. I know deep down that this is something, David, that I have to do. This is not a situation here to where we're just real concerned about Dusty Rhodes' mental attitude, because I done been through that the last 3 weeks. There's something that I want to do, and there's one guy sitting out there right now that's listening to me. Let me tell you something. November the 3rd, Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream, will be back in that ring, and it's going to take a lot of hard work. If it can be done, it can be done right here in this clinic, and I will be back November the 3rd.
In thinking about this injury, I kind of went in with the hypothesis of, oh, he took this time off because his son Cody was born in 80. I knew he was born in 85. I didn't know what time of year. Turns out it was actually June 30th, so he's already a couple of months old. But, you know, you might want to spend time with the newborn, at least a little bit, even if he's, like I said, a couple of months old. The thing, though, is I know they said the injury is a six-week injury. Now, if you have a guy who is a little bit heavier like that, you probably would not follow the normal course for an ankle injury. I mean, I don't mean to, you know, call out Dr. Estwanick or anything like that. I mean, him and his years of experience, he clearly knows more than me. But just from the angle perspective, it feels a little close to Starcade where they're doing this, because it's at the end of November. The injury angle takes place on September 29th at the Omni. That's not a six-week time frame to November 3rd. So, okay, he comes back a little early. November 3rd, oh, there just happens to be a show at the Omni then as well. So he's on that show, and he works up through Starcade. It just, I don't know, it seems like the injury was portrayed as being much worse than a six-week injury. The timing feels just a little bit off, like, if Ricky Steamboat had the throat thing, but it happened on a, you know, late January episode of Superstars, and then they did the WrestleMania match, you know, 8 weeks later or whatever, it kind of feels like that. But this angle itself also calls to mind Greg Valentine and Tito Santana from the year previous, where Tito loses the IC title to Valentine, who hurts Tito's leg. He's sidelined, but not for a particularly long period. And when Tito finally gets back, we get that feud that runs through the whole first half of 1985. And so it was with Dusty and Flair, which pretty much would go through the late summer of 86. You don't really see one-on-one matches with them, at least, you know, the high-profile stuff after the title switch in the summer of 86. Dusty wins it for a couple of weeks and then loses it back to Flair during the course of the Great American Bash. I just think that my own personal doctoral diagnosis of the booking of this is that had they done the angle at the earlier Omni show in September, which was on the first of the month, that may well have given this a little bit more time to breathe. You can do the same vignettes with Dusty where he's hurt. You can play it up as a really serious injury like that. Although on the flip side, you could say, well, Winston, your booking sucks, and you've said so in the past. And that is true, because by coming back too soon, you plant the psychological seed of, well, the dude has an injured leg. And now Flair can attack that, go for the figure four, and, you know, that could be a key part of the Starrcade 85 match. So, I don't know. There are two schools of thought. Just to me, it struck me as perhaps a little bit rushed. And look at me taking issue with JCP 85 storylines when everything is just going magnificent.
Here comes Billy Cundiff to tie this game, and in all likelihood, send it to overtime. The last 2 years, 16 of 16 in the fourth quarter on field goals. 32 yards to tie it. And the kick, look out! Look out! It's no good! It's no good!
I was actually lucky enough to go to the AFC Championship game in January of 2012 in Foxborough because some friends of mine, they were already going, and as it turned out, they had one more space in the car that was going down there. And I looked, I bought a ticket, probably paid too much for it, but whatever, because I was so high up in Gillette Stadium, I was literally behind the lights because they go over the last four rows, so you just emerge from darkness after the game is over because it's 6:30 in January and completely pitch black. But the main thing I remember that game for, and not to circle everything back to my Orioles fandom, but this being January of 2012, this is the Orioles with 14 straight losing seasons, and me, this brand new fan, talking to these Ravens fans who are completely jaded about their baseball team, like, no, I think the Orioles are going to be very competitive this year, and they're all looking at me like I'm a crazy person. Well, you know, I actually turned out to be right for once, you know, broken clock twice a day, you know the deal. So up next, we have Arn Anderson in his hat, along with Tully Blanchard and his stolen television title, taking on Mark Jeffers. And Tully is the caretaker of the championship belt, which is very smart because, as I said, he's very good at holding belts. And Arn, as a squash match worker, and this is going to be a compare and contrast with the next match coming up. I'm not even going to put anything in between because I kind of want to link the two together. He wears Jeffers down by just with such precision going after the left arm, wrist locks, hammer lock. He does the thing where he gets the hammer lock on there and then slams the man on his arm, which is an Anderson trait. Ole would do that, I think, as well. Outside the ring, he uses the ring post, runs the guy's left arm into it there. And I got David Crockett, who comes through in the clutch to set up the comedy rule of three.
Arn Anderson, he calls himself Double A.
MCO.
Would be fun if Arn Anderson could still work and team up with PCO and they could be AA PCO because it wouldn't run afoul of the AMCO copyrights or anything like that. He uses the rope for leverage to work on this guy's arm. He doesn't even bother with like a leg or his right arm. It's just going to work on this guy's left arm, and it's just amazing to watch for the 2 minutes that this lasts. Jeffers actually fires up with some punches, but then he puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran, especially when Arn's finisher is the gourd buster at this time, the sort of front suplex move. And I don't think I've ever done that to a gourd. Generally, I just kind of throw a pumpkin overhand, like a shot put. Or is he supposed to do this to a guy named Gourd? I'm going to need to go through the Arn Anderson squash match list where he's using that as his finisher to see if he ever faced a guy named Gourd, but probably not, because Gourd would be a Canadian name, jobber, and Crockett isn't working Canada anymore because WWF went into Toronto and all that. But just some fun precision stuff. Kind of like the kind of work you would get at an AMCO. He is truly the BMW of squash workers. But up next, to, as I said, the kind of compare and contrast, we have the Mercedes of squash match workers in the Midnight Express.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you now the men you've been waiting for, the human highlight film of professional wrestling, Loverboy Dennis and beautiful Bobby, the Midnight Express.
Get kind of the odd Midnight Express dub that doesn't really sound like the Chase theme that you would hear, nor does it sound like the normal dub that you hear on the WWE Network. It's sort of something in between that sounds like Nintendo menu music or something like that. Something I could have played at the top of the show, I think. They're taking on Gene Ligon, a regular enhancement talent in Jim Crockett Promotions, and Ron Rossi, who is no relation to Rico Rossi, former Kansas City Royals shortstop of 1992. I don't know why I remember him so much. I think he got three hits in a game at Fenway Park that I went to in 92, and I just remember him for that. There's almost no heed paid to any of the enhancement talents on this show. They're not being announced by the ring announcer on camera, which I guess, you know, you'd have to cut stuff to fit everything in. But come on, I like to hear these guys' names. I mean, you could make room, at least compared to the World Championship Wrestling show on Saturday, where I feel like you'd hear them be announced. But hey, you know, I might be just imagining that. So Ligon starts with Condrey, and I'm thinking this is going to be a total Midnight Express squash where they're just going to kick their asses for about four straight minutes. But Condrey actually gets caught by Ligon in the Ted DiBiase-style power slam, which I only give 2 Teds out of 10 on that one. But when Rossi tags into the match, he gets destroyed by a clothesline from Condrey, and now we're going to start to see the Midnight Express stuff that we're more accustomed to when Bobby Eaton gets into the ring. A masterclass in tag team ass-kicking has begun. But I don't get the four-minute beatdown that I'm looking for, as Eaton comes off the top with, very similar to the demolition decapitation move you'd see in the WWF, the Midnight Express are doing this in 1985 in Crockett, but instead of the elbow that Axe would drop, you get Bobby Eaton off the top with a knee drop onto the guy, which just looks infinitely more cool. But in contrasting it with the Arn Anderson match, where he gave virtually nothing to his opponent, it was a little weird seeing Dennis Condrey get power slammed by Gene Ligon at the beginning. I was kind of taken aback. There are two different kinds of squash matches here, and I liked the Arn one a little bit better just because of how precise he was with everything, and it was a complete demolishing, not to use that term again, of the opponent. I don't understand why Dennis Condrey had to give anything to Gene Ligon at the beginning. Now, the Midnight Express, they're on their way to Starrcade, and they are going to face the Boogie Woogie Man, Jimmy Valiant. As we heard earlier, they have that issue, and Miss Atlanta Lively would be teaming up alongside Jimmy Valiant. I'm not sure. I really don't know why Ronnie Garvin liked doing that. He seems to be maybe a peculiar sort of fellow, and that was an Atlanta street fight, and the Midnights actually lost that one, but I chalked that up to them just being able to take that loss and just move on as if it had never happened.
Hello to all of our fans in St. Louis, right here each and every Saturday night, 10 o'clock, right here at KDAL, the best in wrestling.
I'm not sure if you meant 10 p.m. or 10 a.m., because wrestling could be plausibly on at either time. It really doesn't matter. I'm just thinking of it from the Marty McFly perspective, and he's watching whatever Hill Valley is, which presumably is the L.A. market, Southern California. Pretty sure that Jim Crockett Promotions had TV in that area by late 85. So we got the Rock and Roll Express there to do the promo for the St. Louis markets. And going back to last week with Ricky and Robert, and it's not to disrespect Robert Gibson, it's just that Ricky Morton is a little bit better talker than him. I've talked in the past about how Aerosmith, you would always make sure that Joe Perry and Steven Tyler got the exact amount of time on camera in the videos because you didn't want it to seem like you were favoring one over the other. Ditto for Rolling Stones videos with Keith Richards and Mick Jagger. You gotta make sure that it's even. But with Ricky and Robert, because Robert's a cut below Ricky when it comes to talking, as I had said last week, Ricky's got to get two times the amount of time on the stick in order for this to work. So let's do a quick check to see how it goes this time.
You know, Tony, we never had the pleasure of being in St. Louis. We're looking forward to going there sometime, especially going there against the Russians. You know, the Russians, they stole our belts from us, took three of them to beat the Rock and Roll Express. Let me tell you something, Russians, hopefully we do sign a contract right there in St. Louis.
That's right. We're looking forward to coming to St. Louis, Missouri, the show me state, brother, and we're going to show you how come we were the NWA World Tag Team Champions and how come we're going to be again the NWA World Tag Team Champions. When you speak of professional wrestling, you got to speak of NWA because it is the best, the biggest, the major league of professional sports. wrestling, brother, NWA, Jim Crockett Promotion, and you're going to see us, Rock and Roll Express, right here, St. Louis. We're coming at you, and at our best, and we're going to rock, woo, to Somebody Drops.
To give you a peek behind the curtain of how I produce this, what I do when I pull the sound clips is I'll write down the time of when the guys were talking, and this was helpful in this case to measure how long Ricky talked and how long Robert talked. I have Robert checking in at 10 seconds, which means that Ricky should talk for 20 seconds or more in order for my proper Rock and Roll Express ratio to take effect. And Ricky, in fact, spoke for 26 seconds. So I deem this promo proper from the Rock and Roll Express. Meanwhile, we're also going to hear from Magnum TA. And in kind of looking at this time period, I usually don't go back to the observers of the time, at least for more recent episodes, because I don't necessarily need Dave's brand of snark on it. The observers of the 80s seem particularly snarky, but also very, very dickish in terms of his WWF coverage, because he was obviously rooting for it to not succeed because it was not the brand of wrestling that he liked. And that's his right. It just comes off as really odd looking back on it now. But in spite of his feelings about the WWF, he's also kind of turning on Magnum TA as well. He's very grumpy about it. There's mention made about, you know, college kids not liking Magnum. Perhaps it's related to how close he is to Dusty Rhodes and fans favoring Ric Flair over Dusty. Who knows exactly what it is? I've never really noticed any sort of hostility towards Magnum, but then again, I'm not the scholar of JCP from 85 and 86 that others might be. So obviously Magnum is going to be facing Tully Blanchard at Starrcade, but we still have some things to get through to get there. You don't have to convince me to watch that match, I'll tell you that. But it's interesting to see Magnum in the lead up to it.
Tully Blanchard is a man with no scruples. Tully Blanchard is a man calling himself the United States heavyweight champion and being recognized as such because of a theft, because of the fact that he had Baby Doll come down to the ring on one fateful evening dressed as a security guard, hand him a foreign object which enabled him to knock me out and get a 1-2-3, making him the United States heavyweight champion in the wrestling world. Well, that makes him the number one contender for the world's heavyweight championship, and I don't like that. I don't like it because I worked long and hard. I defended that title against all the top competition in the world today. Anybody from Harley Race right on down, I defended that title against, and Tully Blanchard, sooner or later, you're going to answer to me. Sooner or later, the United States heavyweight championship will be mine again.
I actually like Magnum watching this footage, and the only thing that bugs me about him is his name being Magnum TA, and this kind of goes back to the time period when I would see his name in the magazines. I was like, boy, a lot of thought they put into that. Magnum TA, Magnum PI. I mean, yeah, TA is his initials, with his name being Terry Allen, but at least he didn't wear the Detroit Tigers cap like you'd see Tom Selleck do on Magnum TI all the time in the mid-80s. I mean, they are coming off winning the World Series in 84, so they're kind of a big deal. So we go from this Magnum TA promo to a Magnum TA promo, if you can believe it. They actually stacked the two of them back-to-back, and I've been a bit fussy with some show layouts recently. I tweeted this out in the show kind of tweet thread that I have, where I tweet out the link to the show and then I kind of give additional background and thoughts. That's at GF Allentown Pod to give a follow on Twitter for that. Like I had mentioned last week with Memphis, I don't like the way they start their shows, not with, I don't mean by Lance Russell and Dave at the desk introducing us, but they do the theme, they go to Lance and Dave, they tell us what it's going to be on the show, and then they go to commercial right after that. I feel like you should have a match, get people into the show, and then do the commercial after that match. But hey, what do I know? Memphis is the territory that lasted longer than anything else. But the difference between Magnum here and Magnum from the last promo is now he's got the fingerless gloves, which means you're going to see a little bit more fire. And with regard to Tully Blanchard and, you know, the prospect of an upcoming match, perhaps at a Starrcade, he's got a suggestion.
Well, the situation that I'm saying just now is that in order for us to say who the better man is, I need an I Quit match with Tully Blanchard. That's right, a United States heavyweight title match where one man has to say, he doesn't want any more, he's got to say, I quit. The battle's become too intense.
tenth for me. I can't take any more of the punishment. So what I'm saying to you, Tully Blanchard, if you've got the guts, if you've got the drive that you say you do, if you're the real man, the real United States heavyweight champion, we're both laid out right here. But quitting's the last thing on my mind. If there'd been enough time, if they'd given us enough air, I'd have crawled up with my last breath and grabbed you and pounced back on top of you again. And that's what it's all about in the I Quit match. So Tully Blanchard, you say you're the United States heavyweight champion, the number one contender for the World's Heavyweight Championship. Well, I stand before you right now, both feet under me, looking the way I feel. The way I feel is all my intensity is directed at you. And I'm asking Bob Gagel, the head of the NWA, for an I Quit match. They've never done it before, but I'm saying this is the only way that the issue is going to be settled.
I mean, it's not an original thought for me to say, oh, I love that I Quit match at Starrcade, because pretty much everybody does. I can't imagine not liking that match. But it's also nice to be able to go back and watch these shows. Unfortunately, with this not being on YouTube, it's a little bit difficult. But being able to go back, seeing the build to this, and understanding how we get to that point where Magnum is basically going to straight up murder Tully Blanchard in the middle of that steel cage, knowing that there was a double knockout, which is the footage that they show in the background of Magnum talking. That's the crowd noise that you actually hear. That was in Greensboro the week before this, on October 19th. So it's logical now that, okay, we're going to have a cage match. Baby Doll had run interference in the past. Back in those days, when you have a cage match, that would actually keep the interference out instead of everybody sitting with their thumbs up their asses waiting for Chris Jericho to open the freaking cage door so he can help Kevin Owens. Which I say because I remember Hell in the Cell 2016. Yes, it's actual recall of a recent WWE pay-per-view where the whole crowd was just waiting for Chris Jericho to run down, enter the cage, and do all that stuff. It's the difference why a cage match in 85 meant so much more than even a Hell in the Cell match does now. I was also thinking about, for whatever reason, Tessa Blanchard went with Magnum and Tully, because Tully is her actual dad, and Magnum TA is her stepdad. And the fact that her actual name is Tessa Blanchard, and Tessa starts with a T and ends with an A, so you get TA built in there. I'm probably reading it too much into this. But the segment, of course, ends with a David Crockett cock tease where he says, well, we're going to have to find out if we're going to be able to sanction this this I Quit match. We're going to hear from Bob Gagel, because that's just the man we want to hear from, after one more match coming up. So we have to sit through Manny Fernandez versus Jim Jeffers for some reason. I don't know why. I said Jim Jeffers. I don't know if he's related to... I'm pretty sure he's probably related to the Jeffers from earlier. It's Jeffers, not Jeffords. And Jim Jeffords was a senator from the state of Vermont, a Republican senator back when Northeastern Republicans still existed. A guy that I know best as being part of the Singing Senators Barbershop Quartet, and also being the only one who didn't have some sort of controversy follow him later. The other three members of that were former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, who basically said that if a segregationist had been elected president, i.e. Strom Thurmond, we wouldn't have had all these problems. John Ashcroft, who was attorney, who later, after his time in the Senate, would be attorney general for George W. Bush, and also lost to a dead man in the 2000 Senate election. That should not go unnoted, that his opponent died in a plane crash 2 weeks before, and he lost to a dead man. And then the fourth member of the quartet was noted airport bathroom enthusiast Larry Craig of Idaho. So Manny Fernandez had a death match with Abdul the Butcher at Starrcade 85. And also, in looking at the Meltzers, he didn't like that match, which, how insane is that? Because when I think about that one, which was like this weird Mexican death match where you're supposed to go up and get something on a pole. I mean, it was just like a weapons-based thing. I laugh when I think of that match, because I believe that's the one where Abdullah just pulls the fork out, like, in the first 5 seconds and busts Manny open. Like, there's so many guys who bled on Starrcade 85, and just that one match where, you know, you get blood in the first, like, literally in the opening seconds. It's just so incredible to watch and to even think about in this day and age. And the crowd is hot, even for Manny Fernandez versus some job guy while we're waiting for the real news of Magnum TA versus Tully Blanchard at Starrcade. He had a drop kick, some arm work, but you can tell that Tony and David aren't exactly into this match because they're just talking about Magnum the entire time. Reversal of an Irish whip, a leapfrog, and then the flying burrito by Manny finishes it off. And I'm not here to tell you how to order your burrito. You can do whatever the hell you want with it. But if you want to take me up on this, it'd be great. It's when you get your choice of beans, try to choose the black beans because it is a much healthier option than the refried bean. But don't have too many black beans, because if you eat a whole can of it like I did one time, I went a little nuts for black beans back in 06 and 07, because I had just been introduced to them at that time. Yeah, don't do anything like that. Try to limit your consumption to proper levels, because otherwise you're going to be on the toilet for a while.
Well, years ago, we talked to Tom Moore, then at Indianapolis, the offensive coordinator. You got a busted play here, and then Sanchez gets hit. The ball is loose, and it's alive.
I have never seen this before in my life. Watch this. Vince Wilfork is going to throw Brandon Moore back into his quarterback. He's going to fumble the football. This is what Reggie White used to do to people, forklift them and just lift them off the ground. Mark Sanchez not expecting it, and it was the backside of Brandon Moore that knocked the ball out.
Yeah, I could have pulled something from Super Bowl 46 and the Patriots lost to the Giants, such as the Giants purposely committing a 12-men-on-the-field penalty with under a minute to go, to the point where they actually changed the rule on that the following year because the Giants calculated that, yeah, we'll take the 5-yard penalty and have too many men on the field because we're more worried about the clock. Isn't the butt fumble more funny than anything else? The Jets and the Patriots on Thanksgiving in 2012. Certainly the most hilarious NFL play that's ever taken place on Thanksgiving. And that says a lot considering the Detroit Lions play on that day every single year. Now, I needed that to put me in the right frame of mind for Bob Geigel on here to give the decision on the Magnum TA request. And to have this Mr. Magoo deciding anything is just beyond me.
I have here in my hand a challenge. A challenge for Magnum TA for a U.S. heavyweight title match with special I Quit rules. Now, the challenge is aimed at Tully Blanchard, the current champion. You know, Magnum TA held the title. The special I Quit rules, it's so rugged and they're so liberal, it's probably one of the most dangerous matches in professional wrestling today.
Why don't you put on your running shoes and get to the fucking point?
I cannot allow this match to take place. The feeling is so bad between these two athletes. There is so much hatred that I am not going to sanction a match of this nature with two people with a feeling as strong as it is, running as high as it is. No, Magnum TA, I will not grant you permission for this match.
That thing ran so freaking long, I ran out of Spanish flea. It's Bob Geigel saying, oh, we don't want any intensity in our matches. We don't want blood feuds. We don't want any passion behind what is going on out there. That made me wonder, does Bob Geigel run the National Hockey League as well? Because it seems to be going in that direction at times, but that's a whole other story. So Magnum TA, he's got to get his retort into this, and we got to get his reaction. But before he even gets a chance to do that, Baby Doll comes onto the set, and she wants to have a little word with him before he can even get, you know, express his disgust with Mr. Magoo. She hands Magnum a card and tells him to give her a call. So just seems like your normal business transaction. But of course, this is between a man and a woman. And I guess this is the kind of thing that Mike Pence might be afraid of and why he doesn't hang around women.
That's just great.
Okay, darling?
And yet, the seemingly normal transaction between two people within the same business kind of goes a little haywire. Now, I'm not suggesting that Magnum TA was drinking or anything, but what he does here is very similar to what Joe Namath wanted to do to Susie Colbert back at that different Patriots-Jets game from 2003.
I want to kiss you.
Well, instead of just drunkenly saying it, Magnum TA, he's a man of action. That's how you get the name Magnum TA. So he just grabs Baby Doll from behind, turns her around, and kisses her. Now, that would be one thing, the fact that in the modern era, Magnum would be Me Too'd and all that sort of stuff that's been going on the last few years, and it exposed a lot of really bad people. However, what we'll forever remember from this particular incident is not that he just grabbed this woman and kissed her passionately for several seconds, like 24 seconds, for a very uncomfortably long time. It's David Crockett acting like he's in a Life cereal ad. Have to issue a settle down to David Crockett on that one, because she's being grabbed by this 260-pound wrestler, and despite Baby Doll being pretty big for a woman, she could probably handle herself. She's probably not going to be able to get out of his grasp, so to say, oh, she definitely likes it, I don't know, I think that's projecting a little bit, maybe some wishful thinking on David's part. I don't quite get it. So she goes to, like, walk away, and she slaps Magnum across the face, which I think is well-deserved. So Magnum, being the true baby face that he is, when she goes to walk away, he grabs her and rips her top, which I thought was very inappropriate. But this is going to lead to, oh, the greatness of building to that cage match at Starrcade, because you're going to have that one definable moment, and it's Tully Blanchard coming in from behind, and that is where this son of a bitch heats up, where they start brawling on the floor, and I think David Crockett actually takes a shot in the face from Magnum TA as they're kind of rolling around, and Magnum kind of throws a punch, because Crockett, he gets down on a knee to, like, try and, like, break this apart. It's like, there's no hope for him. And the locker room empties out to break this up as credits roll, and I can't even express, I cannot put into words how delighted I am by a Magnum TA Tully Blanchard brawl as Klondike Bill's name is scrolling across the screen and Doug Dellinger as one of the camera dudes to that disco music that they would play at the beginning of the NWA Worldwide shows. Oh my God. This was such a great ending to this show. The whole thing has made me want to go back and watch Starrcade 85 all over again. I'm just going to have to carve out some time, even if I have to jump around. But that is it for NWA Worldwide for October 26, 1985. Again, I thank you so much for listening. There will be no YouTube comment theater because, as I said, this thing is not on YouTube right now. But elsewhere in podcast land, as I understand it, there's going to be the grand return of the Sportscasters with Steve Bennett this coming week, and something big is planned, so be on the lookout for that. On the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and Ring of Honor's own Brawler Malona, see, I can use the correct name now, they take a look at new generation WWF favorites and unfavorites and just things that were absolutely nothing from that 93 to 97 time period. And on the Our Vantage Point podcast with Michael Quinn and Small Joe Murata, they take a look at Val Venus from Tumescence to Refractory period as kind of the rise and fall series, but that's really the only way you can put it with Val, I would guess. Next week on Greetings from Allentown, I've just made an executive decision to do this show because there's something in it that I want to talk about, and I want to talk about right now. I'll be looking at the WWF Superstars of Wrestling from September 30th, 1989, which has a lot of interesting things, such as the Battle of the Dusties, with Dusty Rhodes taking on Dale Wolf, who was forced to change his name, the Rougeaus taking on the Proto Pitbulls, kind of a weird thing with those two teams getting together, Boris Zukov versus Jimmy Snuka in the all-important rematch of that Saturday Night's Main Event match, and the thing that I want to talk about so badly, the coronation ceremony for the Macho King, Randy Savage. So thank you so much for listening again. Be sure to give a 5-star review for Greetings from Allentown on iTunes, Apple Music, whatever it's called. And do tell a friend about Greetings from Allentown. That is always appreciated as well. But do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.